So my niece, I found out, was being teased at school. She's only in like second grade, mm-hmm. and she's being teased about being fat.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, she's not fat.
She's not fat.
No, she's not fat at all. Yeah, she's not fat at all.
Not that it's okay to even tease her if she is fat.
No, but it is a follow-up question, right? Like, are they actually,
sure.
She's not. Her BMI is approximately, no, I'm just kidding. So she, anyways, this little boy has been teasing her about being fat. So we pick up our kids all like outside the school. So she came out and all the other kids come out and all the parents are standing there. And her other aunt also, her daughter goes to the school. So she's there. So she sees her aunt. She's like, oh, hey, she's like, this little boy has been teasing me about being fat. And you can see some parents and being like, oh man, that's, you know, and her aunt goes, you know, like, I'm so sorry. I did hear about that. Your mom told me about that. And, you know, I used to get teased about being like, people used to tease me about that too when I was younger. I think it's just sometimes like, you know, maybe this boy likes you. She's like, but what I used to say is, I can lose weight. What are you going to do about your face? And then she said in front of like all the parents and all the kids. Lap. And I'm pretty sure like the kid who's been teasing her was like very close by. Like, and you just see this like big smirk come on, like, my niece's face. She's like,
she's
okay,
got the key.
Okay,
like,
right, exactly.
Fire with fire.
Yeah.
Don't bully.
But don't bully. Absolutely.
Well, welcome to Guardians Back to Basics podcast. In this podcast, we take complicated medical products. No, we take complicated medical topics and we break them down to basics. And I got pressure because I teased you recently. I just posted the TikTok of me teasing you about not getting the intro right. So yeah. Now I'm like extra nervous about getting the intro right.
People don't understand that the hardest part about hosting a podcast is doing the intro.
This is podcast 47. Why are you starting here? if you haven't heard the intro before, why are you starting at podcast 47? But maybe you just want the recent, most up-to-date news on BLS, which will be our topic today. But before we jump into that, if you're an EMS provider, we do have free continuing education credits for you. You can log into guardiancme.com and watch this and get a free credit.
And if you work for Dr. Pepper, please put in a good word.
Please put in a good word.
We would really like them to sponsor
us.
And
we also have another podcast that we do bi-monthly, which means twice a month.
I believe
so.
But
it can also mean every other month, so don't get confused, because bi-weekly can. I've never really understood that.
That's a good...
You know what I mean? Hmm. Bi-weekly can both mean twice a week and every other week.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Or do we just not know what it means?
No, I think it means both.
Okay.
Anyway, yeah, we have a bad podcast. So every other week, you'll be hearing from us in the Collaborative Practice podcast. Check us out. We interview people in the medical technology and entrepreneur space and basically anything that's up and coming in the medical field that we can kind of come together and collaborate on. We talk to them. We've had some really interesting interviews with people. We got some great ones coming up. So check us out over there. If you don't get enough of Chris and I, and you just want more and more and more, I get it.
And of course you do. Of course you do.
And it's a different setting. We're not in this blue light studio. We're in a very cozy, cool, my basement, so I'm proud of it.
It's just Jason's basement. No, it looks good. It's a good set. So
anyway, today's topic is going to be BLS, or basic life support. So basic life support is something that every provider needs. If you want to be pretty much anything in the medical field, you eventually will have to take BLS. This is basically just CPR. For those of you who may not be in the medical field, this is just CPR for healthcare providers. Basically, it's like what we have to go through for to get our CPR certification. So we know how to resuscitate. So that's why it's basic life support.
I feel like basic life support is one of our favorite topics to talk about. Maybe I'm just speaking for myself.
No.
But because, again, the whole podcast is called Back to Basics. Like, people don't realize, especially in healthcare, we so quickly like want to jump to the big import, like the big stuff, the stuff that seems more important, the like more invasive procedures, the more complicated cases, and nobody does the basic stuff well. Right. And the basic stuff is like the most powerful stuff.
Right.
Like, if you read any research about anything, like in healthcare in general, like, it sometimes feels like the only things that matters is good chest compressions.
Right.
And there's a CPR.
Reason.
It's like, yeah,
there's a reason why it's the first thing that you're taught in any medical program, whether you're an EMS provider, you're a nurse, you're a doctor, like one of the first things you're going to learn.
And we still don't do it well.
Right.
We don't do it well in the field. We don't do it well in the ER. We don't do it well on the floor. Like, we still don't do that well.
Right. And I would say the same thing even for like cardiac arrest, like understanding what cardiac arrest is. Like, sometimes like like CPR is one thing, but like we do CPR on people that are in cardiac arrest. And I feel sometimes like even medical providers like don't even quite understand cardiac arrest. You know
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, like I've talked to multiple providers, and when you ask them like, what are you trying to get blood flow to when you're doing CPR? What's the most important thing? They say the brain.
Yeah,
and that's not true. So like,
yeah.
And again, this is not to like,
I one time had a doctor at an urgent care. This is to like exactly what you're trying to avoid. But I had a doctor at an urgent care one time tell me I started doing the pushy thing.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
CPR.
So yeah, and I wrote it in my report. And it was
of course,
really
you
funny.
Cannot.
I was really, it was like the most passive aggressive EMS report I've ever written. It was pretty
so.
Funny. But anyway, so
well, we need to learn about that pushy another thing. Example. There's a many of you may know this because you've listened to us, but our father is a retired fire chief and he was a paramedic. And did he ever tell you about the case where they called about a pulsatile mass in a guy's neck?
His pulse.
A primary care doctor called 911 and was like, I've got, you know, this is the, you know, this, like 55-year-old male, blah, blah. He has like a pulsatile, like, you know, like a pulsatile thing in his neck. And like, so they went and he's like, it's right here. And it was literally just his crowded balls.
Oh no.
Yeah. So,
but you know what?
This is the importance of bringing it back to basics.
Okay. I don't want
to
say it's okay, but if you're in that boat and you don't quite understand that, we're here to help you out. I'm not going to say that's okay. I'm going to say it is definitely the right thing to recognize it. Let's try to figure it out. But like, I will tell you, like I've taught BLS. I did the math one time. It was like 1,000 times in a 5-year period of time.
Sure, yeah.
And I can't tell you how many people, medical providers or not, like it clicks all of a sudden. They're like, oh my gosh, I never really understood this aspect of it. And now it's kind of all come together and this is going to improve me and everything.
I think
that
that's why we're not good at it. I would almost argue that like some of the reasons that like people, like how many times this happens to me even to this day where I'll be like working in an ER and EMS will roll in with a patient and like doing CPR. And I get that like when you've got a patient on a stretcher and you're trying to roll them into my ER, like it's hard to do good quality chest compressions. But then like they'll transfer them to the bed and like no one will pick it back up for a minute. And it's like, what? But I think it's because we're told this is the most important thing. But I don't know if we really understand why. Because once you really understand, like, it becomes the only thing. It becomes the only important thing. Like even to the point where like, I don't really care about epi or amiodarone or intubating this patient. Like I just really want to make sure these chest compressions go well, because it's probably the only thing that will actually make a difference.
In order of priority, for sure. Like it is.
No, I'm saying I don't intubate or ever give medication.
I'm trying to protect you here. No, but like in order of priority.
Sites, we need an order. I'm like, I can't do just do chest compressions.
But it really is like, if we could, and we've said this before, but when we talk about, when we teach ACLS, when we teach PALS and things like that, like if every provider was an expert in BLS, our cardiac arrest cases would be better than they've ever been.
Yeah.
And I'm saying we took out ACLS. Did BLS like 100% right, our save rates would be
through
the
roof. They've done the surveys of like quality resuscitation. Right. Quality resuscitation, which obviously hinges on BLS. Quality resuscitation measured in lay people who just learned CPR, nurses, paramedics, doctors. The lay people always do better because they're focusing on that one thing, which is the most important thing. And I'm distracted by trying to intubate and do a bunch of other stuff. And I'm like, hold compressions while I, you know, play around with this tube. And you know what I mean? Like, I think that's the problem a little bit. So
chasing all the rabbit trails all the time in your mind instead of paying attention to. Yeah. For sure. All right. Well, let's jump into it quick. The first thing that we have to understand that I explain in all my BLS classes, and it's important to understand, is that we do CPR on patients that are dead. Not nearly dead. We don't really save people when we do CPR. We literally bring them back to life. It's like necromancy. They die. And
you should get like a necromancer badge when you get your first
necromancer badge. This isn't Pokemon.
I don't know.
This is a good topic right now too, because in the news right now, we had that football player who needed CPR done. It was done in front of a lot of people. So like a lot of people are like writing in and asking questions about, there's a lot of opinions and all different areas where people are throwing out. There's some wrong opinions thrown out there, like they did something wrong or they did something right or whatever, you know, but it's very fresh in our minds a little bit about how this works. So like when that happened, he died. Like when we do CPR on someone, we're doing it on a dead body, not a living human being. So how do we define that death? Well, that death is that they don't have a pulse, right? So that's the first thing that we check. But what a pulse is a representation of your heartbeat, right? When your heart beats, it constricts your vessels. When your vessels constrict, it pushes blood flow through those vessels, and we can feel that in a palpable pulse. The reason we check the carotid is because it's the closest to the heart. So if you lose your carotid pulse, the one in your neck, you very likely, your heart is not beating. If it is beating at all, it's not beating enough to perfuse or bring oxygen to your heart itself and the rest of your body. So you're dead. You're legally, clinically dead when you don't have a pulse. So we do not do CPR and save someone from dying. We do CPR on a dead body to bring it back to life. So that's like point number one, right? Talking perfusion. Basic concept of perfusion. In order to survive, we need to perfuse. Perfusion is bringing fluid that's oxygenated to the tissues of the body, right? Our brain has to perfuse. Our heart itself has to perfuse. Our every muscle fiber has to perfuse. It has to have oxygen in it in order to exchange that, use energy, and be okay, right? Lack of perfusion causes death. We talk about this with MIs. We talk about this with strokes. We talk about it with everything, right? I can't really think of a way to die beyond lack of perfusion. Maybe if you're vaporized. Okay, right, but there's not really a way, but
in which case, you would not be perfusing very well.
Exactly. So that's kind of the key to what we're doing. When the heart stops beating, we no longer can move fluid that has oxygen in it around, right? So a lot of people focus in on, oh my gosh, the lack of perfusion seems like that's the most important thing. So therefore, I probably need to oxygenate more, right? So if I need to oxygenate more, it makes sense to concentrate on breaths in CPR. And we thought this for a really long time too, really up until like 15 to 20 years ago. If you look at the history, when I started doing CPR for the first time in my quote unquote career, I was a lifeguard, right? That was actually, you probably were too, right?
Yeah.
The first time you ever did CPR training would have been lifeguard training, right? I was a lifeguard. I was like 14. And even then it was 5 compressions, 1 breath. Was not 30 to 2. I think it was 5 compressions, 1 breath. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, breathe. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, breathe. So we were breathing tons and tons and tons because this idea.
I might be remembering this incorrectly, but I feel like back then there was almost a different version of CPR for drowning. Like they almost like prioritized breaths and drowning more. I could be wrong.
But my training was through the Red Cross. Right. So it was basic Red Cross CPR first aid card. And then you attach that to a lifeguarding thing.
Yeah.
But a lot of breathing.
Right.
Right. So, and we stressed that a lot. We stressed mouth to mouth. We stressed the whole, we got to get them oxygen. And that makes sense relatively, you know, when we're talking about perfusion issues, right? But what we found in the last 15, 20 years is we can look into that hemoglobin and we can see that hemoglobin, which is the cell in the blood or the piece of the blood that holds oxygen, the molecule, mm-hmm. right, that holds oxygen, it has about 4 times the amount of oxygen carrying capacity that we ever thought it did before, right? So the idea behind this then is that when you die, if you die right now, you go into cardiac arrest, your heart stops, you're dead, but you have oxygenated fluid in you. All I need to do is circulate that fluid. And I circulate that around your body once, you drop one O2, then you drop another O2, then you drop another O2, then you drop another O2. And what we found is with the oxygen that's currently in your system, I can keep you going for about 8 to 10 minutes.
Now, before your cells have offloaded all the oxygen to the tissue at this point, now you truly don't have any.
Right.
But the other interesting piece here is that what we've also found is that just chest compressions themselves causes negative pressure in the chest wall. So you passively are pulling air in through the mouth and nose. Even if you're not doing any mouth to mouth, you're not bagging them at all. Just doing the chest compressions is causing negative pressure up and down. And it pulls in enough air with enough oxygen that you actually keep oxygen in your fluid that's circulating.
Right. Eventually you'll run out the amount that you're doing versus the amount that you're using up by trying to reperfuse the tissue. it's going to be negative. So you'll have to do breathing at some point, right? But like, we're talking 8 to 10 minutes, sometimes 8 to 15 minutes. It all depends on the person, the case, right? Like, that's huge. How long does it take EMS to get to a location usually and start advanced airway techniques? Well, depending on your area, 8 to 10 minutes, right? So you activate the code, you get them there, you know, they have a 5 to 7 minute response time, boom, we're there, right? So this is where the shift in education for lay people shifted completely away from airway stuff. In most cases, basic CPR, depending on the organization, basic CPR to the lay person concentrates on compressions only now. And we didn't just do that because people were lazy and they didn't want to do mouth to mouth. So we didn't want to have to, oh, that's yucky now, COVID, like, or whatever, right? We did that because the science backs it up too, right? The second part of that, though, is that if you're a lay person, what do you think is the most likely reason why you're not going to start doing CPR?
Because you don't want to do mouth to mouth.
You don't want to do mouth to mouth, right? And you shouldn't do mouth to mouth. And we're never going to advocate for that.
You don't want the pressure of being someone who's brought people back from the dead. Really, no, that's why. Because like, you don't want, like, that's an expectation now. And like,
you get that necromancer badge.
You're like, oh, this is a lot of pressure. You know, that celebrity status, I think, is usually why, for me at least, that I don't do CPR.
So in my journey of teaching thousands of students CPR, unlike yours, I get two answers usually. One is, I don't want to put my mouth on theirs. That's gross. And I completely agree. Don't ever do that. You should be using some sort of barrier. We'll talk about it. The second is, they're worried about making things worse. Mm-hmm. I don't want to hurt the patient. You cannot make things worse in a CPR scenario. It doesn't get any worse than dead, right? They're not getting any deader. Right? So people get concerned about cracked ribs and stuff like that. And we'll mention that in a little bit. It's not none of the worries, none of the things that you could do in CPR are more harmful than the patient's death. Do it, right? So we want to get you to the point where you're willing to act. And we want to get you to the point where you're willing to concentrate on chest compressions as your main form of resuscitation technique, because that is going to make the biggest difference. And it's because of that science behind it. It's that oxygenation of the tissue is happening when we're just doing compressions. If we want to take this a little advanced for more of you advanced providers, I will tell you right now, in EMS in the UK, they typically, like, their standard of care is like intubate, passively flow oxygen, or do a supraglottic and passively flow oxygen, just do compressions. They don't do bag valve mask ventilations where they're doing positive pressure ventilations where they're squeezing a bag. They just blow oxygen at them. And then they let the CPR pull that oxygen.
I was going to say, because the CPR itself, causing that negative pressure, like as you're pumping up and down on the chest, is pulling enough air and oxygen and air in. Sometimes doing the BVM actually becomes a hindrance to that. Because unless you're like, that's why we do like the 30 to 2, right? And or you're intubated and then you're just passively breathing every, you know, what is it again? Every
8 to 10 seconds.
8 to 10 seconds, right. But even that, like if I'm pushing down while you're bagging, it can almost become like, almost like an issue.
Well, and that's why advanced airways are important when we start talking about advanced medicine along with basic life support, is that I have to interrupt my compressions to do breaths if I don't have a tube going down into their esophagus, right? Because otherwise I'm pushing air two ways. So if I have a tube, I can go ahead and just passively start oxygenating whenever I want. If I don't, I have to stop in compressions. Whenever we stop in compressions, there's an issue. So let's talk about compressions.
I was going to add though, like I don't think this is the case so much anymore, but when I was a resident, and if you're like a nurse or an EMS provider who's worked in the ER, like you're going to remember this too. Like, especially if you worked at a hospital, like a training hospital, it was like a very common thing that, like, especially when like combi tubes and King Airways and these like not endotracheal tube options were available and kind of newer, that as soon as you came into the ER doing CPR with a combi tube in, the ER doctor would just pull it out and then start to intubate, which is like, again, to this point, why that's so dumb and why we should never have done that. And we don't really, I think, do that really anymore. If you've got a secured airway, I won't even intubate them if they're bagging well. If you tell me that they're bagging well, like you're getting good chest rise, I will once we get them established, to your point, because you want to be able to never enter up chest compressions. But I used to have residents who'd be like, can I intubate? And I was like, absolutely. But we're not stopping chest compressions for you.
Right.
So if you can intubate, and I've done that, and you can, right? I mean, you've done this before too.
You really should not be attempting intubation unless you're doing it during chest compression. If you have to have them stop chest compressions to intubate, just drop a King Airway or
Bag them if you can't drop something. Because like, Yeah. And so I would always say, like, you have to be good enough at intubating to intubate without interruption of chest compressions if you want to intubate in the scenario. So.
And here's why that's so important. So what is chest compressions doing? A lot of people think that it's the heart is like a sponge and we push down, we squeeze the blood out of that sponge every time we do a compression, right? So there's blood in our heart. We push on that heart. When we do a compression, it squeezes the blood out and gets blood to the tissues. Nope, not true, right? It's a pump. It's a pump like anything. So you actually have to build up pressure in the system in order to get that blood moving at all. And what we found is it takes usually 12 to 15 compressions to even get the blood going, moving at all, mm-hmm. because you're building up pressure. So you're taking, what we do is we capture the sternum. So we put our hands at the center of the sternum, right? The nipple line. And people ask, like, well, what if it's a woman and, you know, like, and they're bigger, like where the nipple should be is what we're going to say, right? Okay, sure. The center of the nipple line, right? We used to say that xiphoid process lower down, right where like that kind of gap is between your ribs. The reason why we don't push there anymore is we were chipping off the edge of that and it was starting to lacerate internal things, right? So we come up a little higher now, right on the nipple line, put our hands there, we start doing compressions. That basically captures the sternum. The sternum then pushes the rib cage, smashes everything into the heart, and the heart goes bump, right? And then we're going to do that consistently until we've built up pressure in the heart to get blood moving. Now, is this barbaric? 100%, right? It's not. No one wakes up from CPR and feels great afterwards, right? They're not like, oh man, thank you. Like, I needed a stretch. No, they're bruised. It's hard to breathe sometimes. Like, they're all beat up, right? When we do a compression, you're likely to hear some cracking and popping when you push. Now, it is a common thing, even among providers, to assume that this means that you broke their ribs. That is not the case. It's very normal, especially on your first push, to hear a crack. That crack is just cartilage moving, right? Your rib cage isn't used to moving in that direction or under that kind of force. So you'll hear cracking and popping. It'll loosen up after a little bit, but that's going to happen. So stop telling people that that's breaking ribs.
Okay? Also, like, if you think about it, like, from an evolutionary standpoint, the whole point of your rib cage is to protect against the type of force you're doing. So, like, it's meant to be compliable with the cartilage and stuff. So, like, if every time I push on your ribs, they cracked, well, what's the point of you having a rib cage? Right. You know what I mean? Yeah. So that's not, like, can it happen? Sure. Like, I think I can recall, like, one time on, like, a very frail older woman that, like...
And you've done CPR hundreds of times. Oh, yeah, I've done CPR hundreds of times, and I'm telling you right now,
yeah. Like,
it has never... It may have happened to me once. If you break their ribs, like, you'll know it. Like, they're... Well, half this, of like, your you chest
could,
will collapse.
Well, I was gonna say, like, that you then there, the, you started. I started to see like a hematoma. I mean, like, you could very clearly see, but there's it didn't matter. It just, I'm just saying, like, it was again out of the hundreds of times I've done CPR, it was like once.
So, you don't really need to be worried about breaking the ribs. You should expect cracking and popping when you push on their chest, though, right? And again, even if you broke their ribs, even if you're one of the rare cases where you do break their ribs, what doesn't do we care?
Right.
Would you rather wake up with broken ribs or not wake up?
Right.
So, it depends on where you're at in life.
Yeah. Did you check my DNR?
Let's talk about clinical depression. No. So we're pushing on that chest to build up that pressure, right? It takes time to do that. Like I said, 12 to 15 compressions just to build up enough pressure to get that blood to move. So we need to build that up and get it moving. Now the blood's circulating. It's starting to perfuse. What are we trying to perfuse? We're not trying to perfuse the brain. That's an added benefit that we do perfuse the brain. We're not trying to perfuse their toes. We don't care about their muscle tissues and stuff. We're trying to perfuse the heart itself, right?
And this is the interesting part, because this is why one of the things we emphasize is not only the depth, right? You need to be able to push deep enough to, like, get that pump going. Not interrupting chest compressions, because every time you interrupt, you got to restart that pump, which takes 12 to 15 compressions. The other thing that we really focus in on with BLS nowadays is full chest recoil. And this is because what we're trying to perfuse is the heart itself, right? So the coronary vessels that actually feed the blood, because, like, you think about, like, the heart's pumping, but it also has to feed itself blood.
Yeah, it has vessels on top of it that's feeding itself blood.
Right. So those coronary vessels, when you're pushing down, when that heart is constricting, they're also constricted down. So only when the heart relaxes do the actual vessels that feed the heart fill with blood and oxygen and tissue. So it's during diastole, it's during the relaxation period, that the heart feeds itself oxygen. So that's why full chest recoil is so important, because you have to allow the heart to relax and take that pressure off for it to feed itself, because there's no point in me perfusing the brain if the heart itself never has enough oxygen and starts start pumping again.
Right. I've always said it as like at the same time that the heart is refilling with blood, it is feeding itself blood to turn itself on.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's why we need to make sure we come all the way back up. We have that good recoil so that the heart will refill and it will feed itself. Now, why are we trying to perfuse the heart? Because we want it to turn back on so it'll start beating so we don't have to do compressions anymore.
Right. Right.
And then we can move on to other treatments, the cause of their cardiac arrest and so on. But it doesn't really matter how you go down. When you go down, the only thing that we need to concentrate on is getting you back up by doing compressions. Right. So typically in a BLS case right now, the rate of compressions to breath should be 30 to 2 if you don't have that advanced airway in place. So you're going to do 30 compressions, you're going to do 2 breaths. How long should those breaths take? Just about 1 second each. Usually about like take a breath, give a breath. So you're only going to be off the chest for a maximum of 4 seconds as you give those 2 breaths.
But even during those 4 seconds, like the pump that you've primed has to be reprimed again a little bit, maybe not to the same extent as it initially did. But so like then when you start chest compressions again, it takes a few chest compressions before you start really flowing that blood. Yeah. So again, you can imagine if like we're stopping chest compressions every time we intubate, every time to do breaths, every time to transfer the patient, every time to like put on the AED. I mean, like you've defeated the whole purpose of the resuscitative attempt.
Because that pressure we've built up, that coronary perfusion pressure, it's called, will drop down to 0 after 10 seconds. Zero.
Mm-hmm.
So we need it to be at a certain amount, right? But it'll drop to 0 after 10 seconds.
Yeah.
So anything that you do in a code, anything that you do when someone's down that takes you off the chest for more than 10 seconds undoes all the work that you started.
Right.
So that's like one thing that we tell like care teams all the time, like CPP teams and stuff like that. Like you have to make sure that everything that you do that takes you off the chest is taking less than 10 seconds. So what in a code would take us off the chest?
So giving breaths,
sure.
Checking a pulse checks, right? We got to check every once in a while to see if we've got it back.
Exactly. Shocking. If we're shocking, using an AED.
Yeah.
Yep.
What's interesting about shocking, though, is that nowadays with the external devices that do chest compressions for you, you don't have to stop. You can shock them, which is cool. And that's, because again,
you're shocking a robot. You're not shocking yourself.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. So providing shocks if you're doing manual CPR. Really, those are the only three things. Like, it shouldn't be intubating. It shouldn't be putting in a line. It shouldn't be pushing meds. It shouldn't be like anything else. Right.
So that's where we can really, like, when we do advanced cardiac life support, we can concentrate on those care teams, you know, those response teams, rapid response teams, the people that are going to come in the hospital and run those codes. We do a lot of training with them too. It's not advanced training. It's doing the basics perfectly in an advanced way, right? Yeah. And that's what's exciting, is shortening up those times that we're off the chest, concentrating on the basics.
And just because like you shouldn't be off the chest more than 10 seconds doesn't mean that you need to take the whole 10 seconds either. Like when I do a pulse check, I'll do a pulse check for about 5 to 6 seconds, because if I do it any less than that, like what if there's a heart rate of like 40 or 50? Right. So I got to give it some time. But like once I get to 6 seconds and I haven't felt a heartbeat, we're back on the chest. I don't wait the whole 10 seconds necessarily. Exactly. I don't have to, right?
Yeah. So. And that's what they say. And you might not be as well versed as checking a pulse as someone like Chris is. So like they tell you, give yourself like 5 to 10 seconds, but never more than 10, because everything that we do should be less than 10. Right.
So, and selfies shouldn't take more than like 2 or 3 seconds, really. So selfies. I really didn't think you got to count
selfies
that.
With the bodies. That's so morbid. So right. Like that's, and really when it comes down to it, like that's basic CPR. You're going to do 30 to 2 and you're typically going to do 5 cycles of that, which is about 2 minutes of CPR, and then you'll check for another pulse, right? So starting from the beginning, if we back up and we do this real clean, make sure that the scene is safe, make sure that you have proper personal protective equipment on, recognize that the person is down. In CPR, we train people to tap and shout, right? Tap and shout, are you okay? Are you okay? And then if they don't respond, we jump to checking a pulse. Used to be look, listen, and feel. Used to be, do they have breaths? Well, if they don't have a pulse, we know they're not breathing. So we'll worry about assessing that later. That's where we switched from ABC, airway, breathing, circulation, to CAB, circulation, airway, breathing. Now, I don't really know why you can't put your ear down to their mouth while you're checking a pulse at the same time, listen for breaths, look at their chest rise and fall, and feel for a pulse, right? You can do all of it at once. So tap and shout first. Are you okay? Fun fact, I'm just going to throw this ism in here because I do this in my CPR classes, but the song Smooth Criminal by Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
So they're called Rescue Annies. So this crazy story about this girl that died in a river, and they like took the imprint of her face. And that's what created the modern day CPR dummy face. Okay.
Yeah.
So the CPR dummies used to be called rescue Annies.
And some of them still are. Aren't they?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 I mean, there's other types now that don't use that mold face, but the rescue Annies was the like main brand of CPR dummies. So when you learned CPR, you would tap and shout, and you used to say, Annie, are you okay? Annie, are you okay? Because its name was Annie. And that's where that lyric in that song comes from. So it's like someone who's been shot by a smooth criminal, and it's like, Annie, are you okay? Annie, are you okay? Annie, are you okay? Are you okay? And he had just taken a CPR class, apparently. I don't know how we verified this, the story is that he had just taken a CPR class, and he was looking for like filler words. He didn't know how to like, so Annie, are you okay? So, Shimon. Now you know some new information. So cool. So we're going to see him down, make sure the scene's safe. We have our proper PPE on. We tap and shout, are you okay? They don't respond. We check for a pulse. Look, listen, and feel, right? We're looking for chest rise. We're checking for a pulse. How long do we check for a pulse for?
Not more than 10 seconds.
Excellent. Yep. So once we felt for around 10 seconds, we don't feel anything. We're going to jump right to the chest, and we're going to tell someone to call 911 and get an AED, right? AEDs get a little more complicated. We'll talk about those. They don't get more complicated. Understanding them is a little more complicated. But we send someone to get an AED, and we send someone to go call 911, right? And then we just start cranking on that chest. If we're by ourselves, just crank on the chest. Yeah. Honestly, like just crank on the chest the entire time. If you're with somebody and they have some sort of pocket mask or something that can protect themselves with breaths, we can do a head tilt chin lift and do 30 to 2. And we're going to do 5 cycles of that. It's been 2 minutes now. Now we should check for a pulse again to see if they're alive, right? You might ask, why wouldn't I just check a pulse while I'm continuing to do compressions? Because they're going to have a pulse if you're doing compressions on them, because you're going to feel the movement, the blood that you're making. I had a doctor in your ER that you went to residency with.
Really?
I brought in a code, and he kept telling me to stop CPR because I think he was a resident too, but he kept saying, stop CPR, I feel a pulse.
While you're doing
CPR. And I was like, doc, that's me.
So that's it.
So like, don't forget the basics right here, right?
So, well, and here's you want to talk about like advanced basics, like how do you do this really well? To that point, sometimes what I'll do, because sometimes you get, if they have a very faint pulse, it is hard to find. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I'll find the pulse while they're doing chest compressions, right before
where it's at.
Like, I'll find the pulse, right? I feel a pulse. Now stop compressions. Now I already know my finger's in the right spot because I felt it when you're doing compressions, right? Smart. And now I can be like, okay, 5 seconds, 6 seconds, nah, okay, go, right? So that's because sometimes, like, if it's a bigger person or just people's anatomy are different, like where even on yourself, like sometimes it takes a second to find your own carotid pulse. So like finding that while they're doing chest compressions, but doesn't mean they have a pulse.
Exactly. So, and then when we hook, some people say, well, why don't you just hook them up to the monitor and you can see if they have a pulse? Well, that's because an electrical rhythm through your heart that should generate a pulse isn't always getting the heart to beat at that, right? Mm-hmm. So you have an electrical pulse and you have a mechanical pulse, right?
Yeah.
So if I see a rhythm that you can be dead, someone can have the same rhythm I have right now in their heart and be dead.
Yep.
They can be generating that rhythm fine. It's not enough juice in their heart to create that heart to contract. And that's where the issue is. That's why we always check a pulse, even if we have a monitor. Right.
Now, we probably won't get into it. Actually, can we do the next episode on end-tidal CO2?
Sure. If you want to write the outline for
I'll do it.
I hate writing
you
outlines
hate it, right?
on end-tidal okay, no. CO2. No, it's but really interesting
where,
stuff. But
this
there's
is
a lot
where
to it.
In CPR, end-tidal CO2 can become a tool to actually measure whether or not. It's too much to get into right now, but it's definitely worth getting into at some point.
If you have an end tidal reading above
30 to 40.
No, that's normal end tidal is 30 to 40. If you have an end tidal reading of above 15, you're doing accurate compressions,
right?
Yeah.
And
so
if all of a sudden it jumps to 30,
if you see a spike in end tidal CO2, so from wherever you're at to a lot higher than that, they haven't really defined the parameters of what a spike is.
Right.
That's the issue. But if you see a spike in end tidal CO2, you can assume that the only thing that would cause that is cellular respiration.
I had a patient one time who I was doing chest compressions on, and their end tidal CO2 went from 10. I think like you're doing good compressions if it's like 10 to 15.
Yeah. You want to try to shoot for 15.
Yeah, 15.
Is best.
But they were like 10, and then they went to 30. So we stopped chest compressions, and I could not find a pulse. But the end tidal CO2 was 30. And they were like, well, I don't feel a pulse. We got to do chest compressions. I'm like, no, we don't. The end tidal suit, like he is circulating blood. He's a big guy, so it's hard to find the pulse. That was part of the problem. Mm-hmm. I'm like, no, he absolutely has a pulse. You cannot get an end tidal CO2 that high consistently with good waveform unless they have a pulse.
Right.
So it's interesting.
There's like again, talking about like kind of more like advanced basics.
Yeah.
But we can get to a different time.
And then caveat on that for like basic providers or maybe lay people that are listening. Like if you're not sure if you feel a pulse or not, it's okay to continue to do CPR.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like who cares? The heart's getting a little bit of an extra boost. Like it's okay to
no
do CPR.
No one else in the room could have called. Like I was the attending physician. So there's no one else who could have been like, nah, guys, we're like, no, like, yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, it is the end-tidal CO2 becomes a very interesting tool to use for CPR specifically.
Yeah. Cool. So that's the basics of it, is just basically checking the pulse, doing the compressions 30 to 2. After 2 minutes, like when you're checking for the pulse, you're going to go ahead and say, okay, go ahead and pause compressions. Let your partner, if you got someone with you, give the 2 breaths, check for the pulse. At that time, start switching places. Have that person get ready to do CPR again so that you can take a break for 2 minutes, because you're going to, it's an exhausting skill to do this, right? So then we wait for, 5 to 10 seconds, we don't feel a pulse, they start doing it. We do feel a pulse, we're just going to turn them onto their side in case they wake up and vomit, or so there can be drainage of secretions. We're going to kind of turn them on their side and continue to monitor their pulse every couple of minutes to see if they lose it again, because we need to start CPR, mm-hmm. and we wait for EMS to arrive, or we wait for a transport or whatever.
So let's go back to quickly the electrical versus mechanical, right? Because there is the AED tool, right? Yes. We do have a tool that we can use on top of our basics of CPR and that sort of thing. You want to talk about that briefly?
Yeah. So I was going to have like EKGs come up on this video and stuff like that. But for those of you audio, I might be able to explain this in a way without using EKGs.
I think
we'll
we
do an EKG episode soon, honestly. Yeah. But I think we could start by simply saying this. There are only, so you want to get an AED no matter what, 50% of the time that AED won't be used. 50% of the time they will be in what's called
It's more than 50%, I believe.
I think it's like 50-50.
Is it 50-50?
Yeah, because otherwise, yeah. Okay. It went into the study. It's nearly 50-50 where you have VTAC, VFib versus asystole.
So basically there's only two things your heart can be doing when it's not circulating blood. It's either doing nothing, which is asystole. The heart is not pumping.
That's a flat line.
It's a flat line. There's no electrical activity. There's no mechanical activity. Or it's shaky. but we can get into it, but like it's and shaky is not enough. It's not pumping. It's just shaking. Right. That's not circulating blood.
But the problem is electrical. So here's the thing: it's like what killed. If I shoot you with a gun and you bleed out, you might have a fine rhythm in your heart. You might not, but you might have a fine rhythm in your heart. But as the heart starts to go into phases of shock, it can go into that shaky rhythm. But you might have the same rhythm I have right now. Or maybe you die of a stroke, right? And you go down and you have the same rhythm that I have in my heart right now. I wouldn't shock that. I wouldn't shock that because I don't want to mess with that rhythm. I would just do CPR and try to perfuse.
Because the rhythm is the electrical activity. So the cells in the heart are working fine electrically, but for some reason, it's not causing the heart to actually beat.
Right. So the most clear way I can put it is that when we shock a patient, whether we're using a manual defibrillator or an automatic one, so whether you've got EMS that are reading the rhythm and they shock them, or you got hospital staff and nurses reading the rhythm and shocking them, or you have an AED that's analyzing on their own, when we shock somebody with an AED or a defibrillator, we are stopping their heart. We are not starting it. We're not jump starting anything.
Right.
We stop their heart. In fact, most of the time we're putting them into an asystole rhythm. We're flatlining them on purpose.
It's shaky and we want to stop it from being shaky so that our chest compressions can hopefully help the heart restart itself with a normal rhythm that is enough to make it start beating again.
So basically the pacemaker of the heart, whatever's responsible for pacing the heart, is pacing it at too fast of a pace or a weird shaky pace where it is not going to contract. So we have to shut that up by shocking it. And we put them in a flat line. And then we're hoping through our good oxygenation that the real pacemaker will turn back on and give me a nice clean rhythm that will perfuse the heart and it'll keep beating. Right. So I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, well, wait a minute. On every Grey's Anatomy episode I've ever watched, on RoboCop, actually RoboCop was one. I think I've said this before. RoboCop has like one of the most accurate codes I've ever seen in my life, which That's is awesome. Really funny. But anyway, if you go into asystole, you flatline. We don't shock that. Shocking that would do absolutely nothing, because what are we stopping? We're stopping an already stopped heart, right? It wouldn't do anything. So we don't shock a flat line. We don't shock any nice organized rhythm. Like if someone went down right now and they had the same rhythm as me, I wouldn't want to shock that because there's no issue with what's pacing the heart and how it's pacing. There's an issue with enough oxygen to get that heart to contract, right? So we just do CPR on them. We would shock the shaky heart, right? Mm-hmm.
So what AEDs are designed to do is to, you put those pads on and those pads will read the electrical rhythm of the heart and it will tell you one of two things, shock advised or shock not advised. Shock not advised does not mean that that patient has a pulse.
Right.
It, because again, you have the same rhythm that I have right now, but they're dead, right? Only you can check a pulse. AEDs won't check a pulse. You hook that up to them. It tells you no shock advised. It'll tell you continue CPR. Because that's what you should do. Continue CPR, keep checking a pulse, continue CPR, and then have it analyze again later.
It'll analyze on its own. So every couple minutes, it'll analyze, but you don't have to do anything. You just right. let it tell you what to do. So when it'll tell you to hold compressions when it's ready to check again.
And when it's analyzing, hold compressions. Why do we hold compressions when it's analyzing? Because otherwise, it's going to read the rhythm that I'm generating by compressing on the heart. Or it might read my rhythm. There's a bunch of things that can happen, right? So we want to take our hands off. That's one of the only times we take our hands off the patient. And it should analyze in less than 10 seconds because we're right. off the chest.
But, it'll so tell you no shock advised or shock. Here's this interesting thing, though. If a shock is advised, that AED has to charge itself and then will tell you to deliver the shock. When we talk about advanced basics, right, you don't want to be off the chest for more than 10 seconds. So the AED will tell you, hold chest compressions. You stop. It'll analyze the rhythm. And it'll say shock advised. As soon as it says shock advised, we want to start doing chest compressions again because it's going to be a couple more seconds that the device itself has to charge up before it's ready. And those are vital seconds. We talked about like, you know, we want to be staying off the chest that whole time actually could end up being more than 10 seconds. So you want to get right back on the chest, whether it says shock not advised or shock advised, do chest compressions until it says like, you know, ready to deliver
until
shock.
Until your basically. Partner, whoever is operating the AED, is going to hit the button, right?
Right, yeah.
The AEDs will never automatically deliver it. They're called right. an automatic defibrillator because they automatically analyze. They're not automatically defibrillating like, patients.
Yeah, I gotcha.
It's like, not going to shoot you, right? right? So if you get shocked while using an AED, that's because some a-hole hit the button, right? Either right. yourself or somebody else right. hit the button while your hands were still on the patient, right? So deliver the shock when their hands are off, but while it's charging, and it'll charge up and it'll infinitely just sit there and be like, I'm charged. I'm ready to go. You can do CPR infinitely while right. you're doing that. It's just when it's time, that's where we say clear. You know, the person who's operating says, everybody get clear. They check. Okay, we're good to go. No one's touching the patient. We're not sitting in a pool of water with the patient. We hit the shock button. It delivers the shock. And then what do?
We
check a pulse to see if that worked? Nope. We jump right back on the chest right. and we'll check their pulse after 2 minutes.
Yep.
So we're gonna check at the end of our 2 minutes and stay with that rhythm. The AED basically introduces just another round of events happening at the same time yours are.
And only for those shaky heart syndromes, right? Which
now, granted, there are cases where I could be in a flat line. I don't have any electrical activity in my heart and you do CPR on me for a while. And the AED says no shock advised because I'm flatlined. And then because of your oxygenation of my heart gets some electrical activity. But guess what? It goes into shaky heart. Right. So then the AED says, OK, now the shock's advised or vice versa. Maybe you're in shaky heart. You shock it. You put them into a flat line and then you work them for a while and you don't, you know, you're not getting shock advised anymore.
Right.
So if you get shock not advised, it doesn't mean that you're not, it doesn't mean that they're a worse case or anything like that. It just right. means that you either, you know, you're either in PEA, you're either in an organized rhythm or you're in a flat line. And if you get shock advised, it doesn't mean they're always going to be stuck in that rhythm after you deliver the shock. Right. So that's why AEDs are so important because it's kind of 50-50. Like we might see the shocks, we might not see the shocks, but we need to get one available and check for us, right? Mm-hmm. Now, EMS and ER physicians and crash crews, you know, on the floors will be able to have their own way of reading the EKG to determine themselves. They don't need a defibrillator to tell them if it's shockable or not. They'll read it themselves and then go from there. With that, we can wrap it up pretty quick here. So in review, we'll start from the beginning. Oh my gosh, somebody's down. Is the scene safe? The scene's safe. I put my PPE on. I walk over to them. I tap and shout, are you okay? Are you okay? Chris doesn't respond. I put my ear down to his mouth and I feel for a carotid pulse. How long do I feel for?
Less than 10 seconds.
Less than 10 seconds because I need to be off the chest for less than 10 seconds. So check for 10 seconds. I don't feel anything. I start cranking on his chest. I tell someone to go get an AED. I tell someone to go get, go call 911.
That's actually a key piece, I will say.
Yeah,
the
like
calling 911 part is actually really important because like no one's coming
right.
unless you. So people always ask like, well, what if I'm by myself? It is actually better for you to immediately go call 911.
Yeah, I'm tired of this though. What if I'm by myself? You're telling me you don't have a cell phone in your pocket? It's 2023.
Well, that's true.
Like put 911 on speaker and start working them.
Yeah.
Like well, they're like, what if I'm like in the wilderness?
I gotta go find a payphone.
I found a dead body. It's like, okay, well then.
What if I don't have any quarters?
Work them if they don't
make
it.
What if I don't have any quarters and I can't?
Exactly. I don't know. It's just not really problems we bump into, but.
Just make sure you do that part. I guess is what I'm trying to say.
You are right. Yeah. So we usually recommend 2 minutes of CPR first and then go call.
Yeah.
Depends on if you're a peas or if you're not and how viable you are in your history and stuff like that. So I don't know. Pull your
phone out, put it on speaker, dial 911, start doing chest compressions and tell them what's wrong.
Exactly. Right. And then work them. If you can't get an AED, no big deal. Like just work them, just keep working them. EMS will have one, you know, if you're out in the field. If you're on the floor, you're definitely going to have access to a crash cart. So you're going to be fine there. But anyway, yeah, we're going to work them. We're going to do cycles of 30 to 2 if we have a breather. If we don't, we'll just do continuous cycles. One thing that we didn't mention is let's say they have a pulse, but they're not breathing. If that's the case, then we're just going to breathe for them if we have the adequate protections, like a pocket mask. And we're just going to breathe for them once every, it's going to be 8 to 12 seconds.
Yep.
Every 6 seconds you breathe for them.
Every 6 seconds.
And then it's 8 to 10 if they're intubated. I'm sorry. So every 6 seconds or so, 5 to 6 seconds, breathe for them. Very easy,
12 breaths per minute.
Yeah.
Which ends up being about
5 to 6 seconds. And then if they have an advanced airway in place, you only have to worry about 8 to 10 because you're getting 100% of that air that you're putting into them. Something we should mention though. So gastric distension. One of the reasons why advanced airways are important are because they prevent what's called gastric distension. So if I'm breathing air into a patient, it's going down two tubes. It's going down their esophagus, which leads to their stomach, and it's going down into their lungs and inflating them. Obviously, I only wanted to go in their lungs, but I can't do anything about that unless I have a tube that can go down in there, right? So when we're doing basic CPR with a pocket mask or a BVM and we don't have advanced airway techniques in place, or if you're a layperson, you're a lifeguard, you're someone out there that doesn't have access to that, 50% of that air is going into the stomach. The lungs will inflate and deflate, and that's great, but the stomach will trap air in it. So over time, you'll see their stomach become distended and get puffy. And then eventually, just like when you burp or fart when you're living, you know, the body needs to get rid of that trapped air and it will bring fluid with it. So the patient will start to vomit. And that can lead to complications. They could inadvertently, that vomit could go down their trachea now and get in their lungs, and that can cause some issues. It could create a big mess, right? They might vomit on your mouth if you're doing mouth to mouth, which is why I never recommend doing mouth to mouth. That's disgusting. That's why you want to use a pocket mask. It protects you. It has that barrier. But just so you know, if a patient starts vomiting, I know we watch like a lot of like movies and shows where you see them like spit up. It's usually after a drowning, like in a lifeguarding thing, right? They like spit up and you're like, oh, we got them back sort of thing. Right. Well, that's because you got water out of their lungs, different type of mechanic, right? If a patient starts vomiting during a code, it does not mean that they're alive.
Right.
Doesn't mean the body, a dead body can vomit because you're pushing air into the stomach. And that's why advanced airways.
And nothing's worse than a vomiting dead body.
But all you would do is you turn that body on their side, let that drain off, clean it up. Are they going to be a mess now? Are you going to not want to do breaths? Probably not. Just do compressions, especially if you're out in the field. But yeah, that's something that can happen. So don't let that panic you. But anyway, back to our scenario here. We're doing CPR 30 to 2 or just continuous compressions until every 2 minutes. We're going to check when the AED arrives. We'll hook it up. And we'll continue our compressions.
I always like to say, we're not going to pause compressions for me to get the AED on. I'm going to work around the person who's doing the chest compressions in order to put that AED on.
Exactly. You know,
those stickers and stuff.
So. And then the AED will interrupt us and tell us when to get off the chest when it's analyzing. Once it's analyzed and it gives me shock advise or shock not advise, I can jump right back on the chest and do that infinitely until the person who's going to hit the button to shock the patient is ready to say clear and we all clear, right?
Right.
If you were to get shocked, it's not going to kill you. I mean, you have to have a pretty weak heart. So what happens is the electrical impulse is going to split between the patient and the person touching the patient. It hurts. It feels like you grabbed a line. Like that's what it feels like. If you ever shocked yourself, like putting a light in, it feels like that.
Yeah. The danger in you getting shocked when the AED fires is that the patient isn't getting the full dose of electrical. So it's less effective. We don't really care that you got
shocked.
It's not
enough to stop your heart. Yeah, therefore, it's not enough to stop the patient's heart, which means that we're going to have to recharge and shock them again or let the AED cycle through. Right. So be safe. You know, make sure that your hands are up, but don't be terrified of these devices. Like if you get that, it's happened to me before. It's happened to you too, right?
I don't think I ever actually have been.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I usually sit. I like to stand by the foot of the bed, by the door. I try to tell people what to do. That's kind of my thing. Right. That's kind of what I like to do.
Cool, yeah. Cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Definitely winning the hearts and minds of our viewers. So anyway,
I don't put gloves on either.
Try not to shut up.
No, but I actually don't.
I know, team lead.
Team lead. Yeah, you really,
I say recommend Chris that. Has the belief, and I believe in this too. If you're the team lead of a scenario, don't even put gloves on because it stops you from jumping into a role where you're no longer the team lead. And right. Now who's leading the code and seeing it from a bird's eye?
Also, I don't want to get my nice.
That's why Chris doesn't
dirty.
Even get dressed. Chris doesn't even show up to a hospital in scrubs.
No,
because his whole thing is he should be in charge.
Yeah, I come in a suit and a tie, and I don't get near anything that can make me dirty.
All right, let me wrap this up because I'm trying to keep it short.
All right, it's not short.
So keep doing CPR to them until EMS arrives, or you transfer them, or whatever.
Or
right?
You can't anymore.
Yeah, you can't anymore. Right. And if you bring them back, turn them on their side, monitor their pulse. Start treating their other issues. Like you might want to start thinking about things like what caused them to die. Mm-hmm. Was it a heart attack? Was it a stroke? Was it, I'm just going to start naming off all the things that kill you. What am I doing?
Yeah,
I'm trying to keep it short. Anyway, there's lots of things. There's things called reversible causes that in a code you can look at and start doing some treatments for. But that's more advanced stuff. And we're sticking with basic life support today. So cool. That, I think, wraps it up. As always, check out GuardianCME.com if you're an EMS provider and you want to get a credit for this. And also check out our other sister podcast. It's the same two people.
It is.
The brother podcast, really.
Right, yeah.
So our other podcast, Collaborative Practice. And listen to us talk to other people if you're sick of hearing us all the time.
No, it's a good podcast. Like we explore... It's very different than this one, and we talked to a lot of cool people doing some really cool things in healthcare and tech and innovation. So yeah, definitely check that out. Awesome. Well, yeah, thank you guys so much. Like I said, I do hope this is helpful to people. I mean, sometimes it can be boring to go back to the basics, but I actually think it's awesome. Like this is like you when you really understand the basics, everything else starts to make way more sense. All your advanced treatments make way more sense and are more effective because you're doing the basics well. So hope you guys took something away from it, and we will see you next time.
Stay sweet.
Hey guys, thanks so much for taking a listen. If you are studying for the National Registry exam, we're here to help. We have a National Registry prep program to help you pass that exam. Check us out at guardiantestprep.com. If you'd like continuing education credits for listening to our podcast or watching this on YouTube, follow us at guardianCME.com. 100% free CAPC credits. No matter what state or country you're in, we're here to help. So again, we thank you so much for listening. We hope you have a wonderful week.